After her transformation, Hannah had been neurotically careful about not only looking cool and perfect at all times, but being cool and perfect too. Terrified that the tiniest mistake would send her spiraling back to dorkdom, she labored over every last detail, from little things like the perfect IM screen name and the right mix for her car's built-in iPod, to bigger stuff, like the right combo of people to invite over before someone's party, and choosing the perfect it boy to date, who, luckily, was the same boy she'd loved since seventh grade. Had getting caught for shoplifting just tarnished the perfect, controlled, uber-cool Hannah everyone had come to know? She hadn't been able to read that look on Mona's face when she said, "Yikes." Had the look meant, "Yikes, but no big deal?" Or, "Yikes, what a loser." She wondered if maybe she shouldn't have told Mona at all. But then, someone else already knew. A. Know what Sean's going to say? Not it. Hannah's field of vision went blurry. She squeezed the steering wheel for a few seconds, then jammed the key into the ignition and rolled out of the country club parking lot to a gravelly, dead-end turnoff a few yards down the road. She could hear her heart pounding at her temples as she turned off the engine and took deep breaths. The wind smelled like hay and just mown grass. Hannah shut her eyes tight. When she opened them, she stared at the container of sweet potato fries. "Don't," she thought. A car swished by on the main road. Hannah wiped her hands on her jeans. She snuck another peek at the container. The fries smelled delicious. Don't. She reached over for them and opened the lid. Their sweet, warm smell wafted into her face. Before she could stop herself, Hannah shoved handful after handful of fries into her mouth. The fries were still so hot that they burned her tongue, but she didn't care. It was such a relief. This was the only thing that made her feel better. She didn't stop until she'd eaten them all and even licked the sides of the container for the salt that had gathered at the bottom. At first, she felt much, much calmer. But by the time she pulled into her driveway, the old, familiar feelings of panic and shame had welled up inside her. Hannah was amazed how, even though it had been years since she'd done this, everything felt exactly the same. Her stomach ached, her pants felt tight, and all she wanted was to be rid of what was inside of her. Ignoring Dot's excited cries from her bedroom, Hannah bolted to the upstairs bathroom, slammed the door, and collapsed onto the tiled floor. Thank God her mom wasn't home from work yet. At least she wouldn't hear what Hannah was about to do. 12. Love that new test score smell. Okay, Spencer had to calm down. Wednesday night, she pulled her black Mercedes C-Class hatchback, her sister's cast-off car, since she got the new, practical Mercedes SUV, into the circular driveway of her house. Her student council meeting had gone extra late, and she'd been on edge driving through Rosewood's dark streets. All day, she'd felt like someone was watching her, like whoever had written that covet email could jump out at her at any second. Spencer kept thinking uneasily about that familiar ponytail in Allison's bedroom window. Her mind kept going back to Allie, all the things she knew about Spencer. But no, that was crazy. Allison had been gone, and most likely dead, for 3 years. Plus, a new family lived in her house now, right? Spencer ran to the mailbox and pulled out a pile, tossing everything back that wasn't hers. Suddenly, she saw it. It was a long envelope, not too thick, not too thin, with Spencer's name typed neatly in the window pane. The return address said, "The College Board." It was here. Spencer ripped open the envelope and scanned the page. She read the PSAT results 6 times before it sunk in. She'd gotten a 2350 out of 2400. "Yes!" she screamed, clutching the papers so tightly they wrinkled. "Whoa, someone's happy," called a voice from the road. Spencer looked up. Hanging out the driver's side window of a black Mini Cooper was Andrew Campbell, the tall, freckly, long-haired boy that beat out Spencer for class president. They were number one and number two in the class in practically every subject. But before Spencer could brag about her score, telling Andrew about her PSATs would feel so good, he peeled away. Freak. Spencer turned back to her house. As she excitedly scampered inside, something stopped her. She remembered her sister's near-perfect score and quickly converted it from the 1600 scale they used to use into the 2400 scale the College Board used nowadays. It was a full 100 points lower than Spencer's. And weren't they supposed to be harder these days, too? Well, now who's the genius? An hour later, Spencer sat at the kitchen table reading Middlemarch, a book on the English AP suggested reading list, when she began to sneeze. "Melissa and Ren are here," Mrs. Hastings said to Spencer as she bustled into the kitchen, carrying in the mail Spencer had left in the box. "They've brought all of their luggage to move in." She opened the oven a crack, checking on the rotisserie chicken and 7 grain rolls, and then bustled into the living room. Spencer sneezed again. A cloud of Chanel No. 5 always preceded her mom, even though she spent the whole day working around horses, and Spencer was certain she was allergic. She considered announcing her PSAT news, but a twinkly voice from the foyer stopped her. "Mom?" Melissa called. She and Ren strolled into the kitchen. Spencer pretended to study Middlemarch's boring back cover. "Hey," Ren said above her. "Hey," she answered coolly. "What you reading?" Spencer hesitated. It was better to steer clear of Ren, especially now that he was moving in. Melissa brushed by without saying hello and began to unpack purple pillows from a Pottery Barn bag. "These are for the couch in the barn," she practically yelled. Spencer cringed. Two could play at this game. "Oh, Melissa," Spencer cried. "I forgot to tell you. Guess who I ran into?" Melissa continued to unpack the pillows. "Who?" "Ian Thomas. He's coaching my field hockey team now." Melissa froze. "He... what? He is? He's here? Did he ask about me?" Spencer shrugged and pretended to think. "No, I don't think so." "Who's Ian Thomas?" Ren asked, leaning against the Marble Island counter. "No one," Melissa snapped, turning back to the pillows. Spencer slapped her book shut and skipped off to the dining room. There, that felt better. She sat down at the long, mission-style farmhouse table, running her finger around the stemless wine glass Candace, the family's housekeeper, had just filled with red wine. Her parents didn't care if their kids drank while they were at home as long as no one was driving, so she grabbed the glass with both hands and greedily took a large gulp. When she looked up, Ren was smirking at her from across the table, his spine very straight in his dining chair. "Hey," he said. She raised her eyebrows in answer. Melissa and Mrs. Hastings sat down, and Spencer's father adjusted the chandelier lights and took a seat as well. For a moment, everyone was quiet. Spencer felt for the PSAT score papers in her pocket. "So, guess what happened to me?" she began. "Ren and I are so happy you're letting us stay here," Melissa said at the same time, grabbing Ren's hand. Mrs. Hastings smiled at Melissa. "I'm always happy when the family's all here." Spencer bit her lip, her stomach nervously gurgling. "So, Dad, I got my..." "Uh-oh," Melissa interrupted, staring down at the plates Candace had just brought in from the kitchen. "Do we have anything other than chicken? Ren's trying not to eat meat." "It's all right," Ren said hastily. "Chicken is perfect."
"Oh!"
Mrs. Hastings stood up halfway.
"You don't eat meat?
I didn't know. I think we may have some pasta salad in the fridge, although it might have ham in it. Really, it's okay. Ren rubbed his head uncomfortably, making his messy black hair stand up in peaks. Oh, I feel terrible, Mrs. Hastings said.
Spencer rolled her eyes.
When the whole family was together, her mom wanted all meals, even sloppy cereal breakfasts, to be perfect. Mr. Hastings eyed Ren suspiciously.
I'm a steak man myself.
Absolutely. Ren lifted his glass so forcefully that a little wine spilled on the tablecloth. Spencer was considering a good segue into her big announcement when her father laid down his fork.
I've got a brilliant idea. Since we're all here, why don't we play Star Power?
Oh, Daddy, Melissa grinned. No. Her father smiled.
Oh, yes. I had a terrific day at work. I'm going to kick your butt.
What's Star Power? Ren asked, his eyebrows arched. A nervous glow grew in Spencer's stomach. Star Power was a game her parents had made up when Spencer and Melissa were little kids that she'd always suspected they'd pilfered from some company power retreat. It was simple. Everyone shared their biggest achievement of the day, and the family would select one star. It was supposed to make people feel proud and accomplished, but in the Hastings family, people just got ruthlessly competitive. But if there was one perfect way for Spencer to announce her PSAT results, Star Power was it.
You'll catch on, Ren,
Mr. Hastings said.
I'll start. Today, I prepared a defense so compelling for my client, he actually offered to pay me more money.
Impressive, her mother said, taking a tiny bite of a golden beet. Now me. This morning, I beat Eloise at tennis in straight sets.
Eloise is tough,
her father cried before taking another sip of wine. Spencer peeked at Ren across the table. He was carefully peeling the skin off his chicken thigh so she couldn't catch his eye. Her mother dabbed her mouth with her napkin. Melissa? Melissa laced her stubby-nailed fingers together. Well, I helped the builders tile the entire bathroom. The only way it'd be perfect is if I did it myself.
Good for you, dear, her father said.
Spencer jiggled her legs nervously. Mr. Hastings finished sipping his wine.
Ren?
Ren looked up, startled.
Yes? It's your turn.
Ren fiddled with his wine glass.
I don't know what I should say.
We're playing Star Power, Mrs. Hastings chirped, as if Star Power were as common a game as Scrabble. What wonderful thing did you, Mr. Doctor, achieve today?
Oh, Ren blinked. Well, nothing, really. It was my day off from school and the hospital, so I went down to the pub with some hospital friends and watched the Phillies game.
Silence. Melissa shot Ren a disappointed look.
I think that's awesome, Spencer offered. The way they've been playing, it's a feat to watch the Phillies all day.
I know. They're kind of crap, aren't they? Ren smiled at her gratefully.
Well, anyway, her mother interrupted.
Melissa, when do you start class?
Wait a minute, Spencer piped up. They were not about to forget her. I have something for Star Power.
Her mother's salad fork hung in the air.
I'm sorry.
Oops,
her father agreed jocularly.
Go ahead, Spence.
I got my PSAT results, she said. And, well,
here. She pulled out the scores and shoved them at her father. As soon as he took them, she knew what would happen. They wouldn't care. What did PSATs matter anyway?
They'd go back to their Beaujolais and to Melissa and Wharton, and that would be that.
Her cheeks felt hot. Why did she even bother? Then her dad put down his wine glass and studied the paper.
Wow.
He motioned Mrs. Hastings over. When she saw the paper, she gasped.
You can't get much higher than this, can you? Mrs. Hastings said. Melissa craned her neck to look, too. Spencer could hardly breathe. Melissa glared at her over the lilac and peony centerpiece. It was a look that made Spencer think that maybe Melissa had written that creepy email yesterday. But when Spencer met her eye, Melissa broke into a smile. You really studied, didn't you?
It's a good score, yeah?
Wren asked, glancing at the page.
It's a fantastic score, Mr. Hastings bellowed.
This is wonderful, cried Mrs. Hastings. How would you like to celebrate, Spencer? Dinner in the city? Is there something you've had your eye on? When I got my SAT scores, you got me a Fitzgerald first edition at that estate auction, remember? Melissa beamed. That's right, Mrs. Hastings trilled. Melissa turned to Wren. You would have loved it. It was so amazing to bid. Well, why don't you give it some thought? Mrs. Hastings said to Spencer. Try to think of something memorable, like what we got for Melissa. Spencer slowly sat up. Actually, there is something that I have in mind.
What's that?
Her father leaned forward in his chair. Here goes, Spencer thought. Well, what I'd really, really, really love, right now, not a few months from now, would be to move into the barn. But, Melissa started, before stopping herself. Wren cleared his throat. Her father furrowed his brow. Spencer's stomach made a loud, hungry growl. She covered it with her hand. Is that what you really want? Her mother asked. Uh-huh. Spencer answered. Okay, Mrs. Hastings said, looking at her husband. Well, Melissa loudly laid down her fork. But, what about Wren and me? Well, you said yourself the renovations wouldn't take too long. Mrs. Hastings put her hand to her chin. You guys could stay in your old bedroom, I suppose. But it has a twin bed. Melissa said in an uncharacteristically childish voice. I don't mind, Wren said quickly. Melissa scowled sharply at him.
We could move the queen bed from the barn to Melissa's room and put Spencer's bed out there,
Mr. Hastings suggested. Spencer couldn't believe her ears. You would do that? Mrs. Hastings raised her eyebrows. Melissa, you can survive, can't you? Melissa pushed her hair back from her face. I guess, she said. I mean, I personally got much more out of the auction in the first edition, but that's just me. Wren discreetly took a sip of his wine. When Spencer caught his eye, he winked. Mr. Hastings turned to Spencer.
Done then.
Spencer jumped up and hugged her parents. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Her mother beamed. You should move in tomorrow.
Spencer, you're certainly the star.
Her father held up her scores, now slightly stained with red wine.
We should frame this as a memento.
Spencer grinned. She didn't need to frame anything. She'd remember this day for as long as she lived. 13. Act 1. Girl makes boy want her. Want to come with me to an artist reception at the Chester Springs studio next Monday night? Aria's mother, Ella, asked. It was Thursday morning, and Ella was sitting across from Aria at the breakfast table, doing the New York Times crossword puzzle with a leaky black pen and eating a bowl of Cheerios. She had just returned to her part-time job at the Davis Contemporary Art Gallery on Rosewood's main drag, and she was on the mailing list for all the benefits. Isn't Dad going to go with you? Aria asked. Her mom pursed her lips together. He has a lot of work to do for his classes. Oh. Aria picked at a loose strand of wool on the fingerless glove she'd knitted during a long train ride to Greece. Was that suspicion she detected in her mom's voice? Aria always worried Ella would find out about Meredith and never forgive her for keeping the secret. Aria squeezed her eyes closed. You're not thinking about it, she thought. She poured some grapefruit juice into a glass. Ella, she asked, I need some love advice.
Love advice? Her mother teased, securing her jet black bun with a takeout chopstick that had been lying on the table.
Yeah, Aria said. I like this guy, but he's kind of unattainable. I'm out of ideas on how to convince him he should like me.
Be yourself, Ella said. Aria groaned. I've tried that. Go out with an attainable boy, then.
Aria rolled her eyes. Are you going to help or not?
Ooh, someone's sensitive. Ella smiled, then snapped her fingers. I just read this study in the paper. She held up the Times. It was a survey about what men find most attractive in women. You know what was the number one thing? Intelligence. Here, let me find it for you. She rifled through the paper and handed the page to Aria.
Aria likes a guy.
Mike swept into the kitchen and grabbed a glazed donut from the box on the island.
No, Aria quickly responded.
Well, someone likes you, Mike said. Gross as that is.
He made a barfing sound.
Who?
Ella asked in an excited voice.
Noel Kahn,
Mike answered, talking with a huge, chewed-up bite of donut in his mouth.
He asked about you at lacrosse practice.
Noel Kahn?
Ella echoed, looking back and forth from Mike to Aria.
Which one is he? Was he here 3 years ago? Do I know him?
Aria groaned and rolled her eyes.
He's nobody.
Nobody?
Mike sounded disgusted.
He's like the coolest guy in your grade.
Whatever, Aria said, kissing her mother on the top of her head.
She headed to the hallway, staring at the newspaper clipping in her hands. So men liked brains? Well, Icelandic Aria could certainly be brainy.
Why don't you like Noel Kahn?
Mike's voice made Aria jump. He stood a few feet away from Aria with a carton of orange juice in his hand.
He's the man.
Aria groaned. If you like him so much, why don't you go out with him? Mike drank straight from the carton, wiped his mouth, and stared at her.
You've been acting freaky. Are you high? Can I have some if you are?
Aria snorted. In Iceland, Mike had been constantly trying to score drugs and freaked when some guys at the harbor sold him a dime bag of pot. The stuff turned out to be skunky, but Mike proudly smoked it anyway. Mike started stroking his chin.
I think I know why you're acting freaky.
Aria turned back to the closet. You're full of crap.
You think so?
Mike answered.
I don't. And you know what? I'm going to find out if my suspicions are true.
Good luck, Sherlock.
Aria pulled at her jacket. Even though she knew Mike was probably full of shit, she hoped he hadn't noticed the quiver in her voice. As the other kids filed into English, most of the boys sporting a few days' growth of stubble, and most of the girls in copycat Mona and Hannah platform sandals and charm bracelets, Aria reviewed her just-scrawled stack of note cards. Today, they had to give an oral report about a play called Waiting for Godot. Aria adored oral reports. She had the perfect, sexy, gravelly voice for them, and she happened to know the play really well. Once, she'd spent a whole Sunday in a Reykjavik bar, vehemently arguing with an Adrian Brody lookalike about its theme. Between swilling delicious apple vodka martinis and playing footsie with him under the table, that is. So not only was this an excellent day to become Uber student, it was also a great opportunity to show everyone how cool Icelandic Aria was. Ezra strolled in, looking rumpled, bookish, and completely edible, and clapped his hands.
Okay, class, he said. We have a lot of stuff to get through today. Quiet down.
Hannah Marin turned around and smirked at Aria.
What kind of underwear do you think he's wearing?
Aria smiled blandly. Striped cotton boxers, of course, but snapped her attention back to Ezra.
All right.
Ezra walked to the chalkboard.
Everyone did the reading, right?
Everyone has a report? Who wants to go first?
Arya's hand shot up. Ezra nodded at her. She walked to the podium at the front of the room, arranged her black hair around her shoulders so that it looked extra gorgeous, and made sure that her chunky coral necklace wasn't caught in the collar of her shirt. Quickly, she reread the first few scene-setting sentences on her index cards. Last year, I attended a performance of Waiting for Godot in Paris, she began. She noticed Ezra raise his eyebrow just the tiniest bit. It was a small theater off the Seine, and the air smelled like the cheese brioche baking next door. She paused. Picture the scene. A huge line of people waiting to go in. A woman toting her two little white poodles. The Eiffel Tower in the distance. She briefly looked up. Everyone seemed so transfixed. I could feel the energy, the excitement, the passion in the air. And it wasn't just the beer they were selling to everyone. Even my little brother, she added.
Nice! Noel Kahn interjected.
Arya smiled. The seats were very velvety and purple, and smelled like this type of butter in France that's sweeter than American butter. It's what makes the pastries so delicious.
Arya, Ezra said.
It's the kind of butter that even makes escargot taste good.
Arya!
Arya stopped. Ezra leaned against the chalkboard with his arms crossed over his rosewood blazer. Yes, she smiled.
I have to stop you.
But I'm not even halfway done.
Well, I need less about velvet seats and pastries and more about the play itself.
The class snickered. Arya shuffled back to her seat and sat down. Didn't he know she was creating ambiance?
Noel Kahn raised his hand. Noel?
Ezra asked.
You want to go next?
No.
Noel said.
The class laughed.
I just wanted to say, I thought Arya's report was good. I liked it.
Thanks, Arya said quietly. Noel swiveled around.
Is there really no drinking age?
Not really.
I might go with my family to Italy this winter.
Italy's amazing. You're going to love it.
Are you two through?
Ezra asked. He shot Noel an exasperated look. Arya dug her hot pink nails into the wood grain of her desk. Noel turned back to her again.
Did they have absinthe?
He whispered. She nodded, amazed Noel had even heard of absinthe.
Mr. Kahn,
Ezra interrupted sternly. A little too sternly.
That's enough.
Was this jealousy she detected?
Damn,
Hannah twisted around. What crawled up his ass? Arya stifled a giggle. It seemed to her like a certain Uber student was making a certain teacher a little twitchy. Ezra called on Devin Arliss next, and she started her speech. As Ezra turned to the side and put his finger on his chin, listening, Arya throbbed. She wanted him so badly it made her whole body buzz. No, wait. That was just her cell phone, which was nestled in her oversized lime-green tote next to her foot. The thing kept buzzing. Arya slowly reached down and pulled it out. One new text message. Arya. Maybe he fools around with students all the time. A lot of teachers do. Just ask your dad. A. Arya quickly snapped her cell phone shut, but then she opened it and read the message again. And again. As she did, the little hairs on her arm stood straight up. No one in the room had their phones out. Not Hannah, not Noel, nobody. And no one was looking at her either. She even looked up on the ceiling and out the classroom door, but nothing seemed out of place. Everything was quiet and still. This can't be happening, Arya whispered. The only person who knew about Arya's dad was Allison. And she'd sworn on her grave she wouldn't tell a soul. Was she back? 14. That'll teach you to Google stalk when you're supposed to be studying. During her free period Thursday afternoon, Spencer strode into the Rosewood Day reading room. With its ceiling-high stacks of reference books, giant pedestal globe in the corner, and stained glass window on the far wall, it was her favorite place on campus. She stood in the middle of the empty room, closed her eyes, and inhaled the old, leather-bound book smell. Everything had gone her way today. The unusual cold snap had allowed her to wear her brand-new Marc Jacobs pale blue wool coat. The Rosewood Day Cafe barista had made her a perfect double-skim latte. She just aced a French oral exam, and tonight she would be moving into the barn, while Melissa had to sleep in her old, cramped bedroom. Despite all that, an uneasy haze hung over her. It was a cross between a bothersome feeling she sometimes had when she'd forgotten to do something, and the sense that someone was, well, watching her. It was obvious why she was feeling so off. That creepy Covet email. The flash of blonde hair in Allie's old window. The fact that only Allie knew about Ian. Trying to shake it off, she sat down at the computer, adjusted the waistband of her navy blue Wolford patterned stockings, and logged on to the internet. She began research for her upcoming AP Bio project, but after scrolling through a list of Google results, she typed Ren Kim into the search engine. Trolling through the results, she stifled a giggle. On a site called Mill Hill School, London, there was a photo of a longer-haired Ren standing next to a Bunsen burner and a bunch of test tubes. Another link was to Oxford University's Corpus Christi College student portal. There was a photo of Ren looking gorgeous in Shakespearean garb, holding a skull. She hadn't known Ren was into drama. As she tried to magnify the photo to check out the fit of his tights, someone tapped her on the shoulder. "That your boyfriend?" Spencer jumped, knocking her crystal-studded sidekick cell phone to the floor. Andrew Campbell grinned awkwardly behind her. She quickly closed the window. "Of course not." Andrew bent down to pick up her sidekick, pushing a lock of straight, shoulder-length hair out of his eyes. Spencer noticed that he might actually have a chance at being cute if he cut off that lion's mane. "Oops," he said, handing the sidekick back to her. "I think a jewel thing fell off." Spencer grabbed it from him. "You scared me." "Sorry about that." Andrew smiled. "So, your boyfriend's an actor?"
"I said he wasn't my boyfriend."
Andrew stepped back.
"Sorry, just making conversation."
Spencer eyed him suspiciously.
"Anyway,"
Andrew went on, hefting his North Face backpack higher on his shoulder,
"I was wondering, you going to Knowles tomorrow? I could give you a ride."
Spencer looked at him blankly and then remembered. Noel Kahn's field party. She'd gone to last year's. Kids did beer funnels, and practically every girl cheated on her boyfriend. This year would be more of the same. And what, Andrew seriously thought she'd ride with him in his mini? Would they both even fit? "Doubt it," she said. Andrew's face fell.
"Yeah, I guess you're probably kind of busy."
Spencer furrowed her brow. What's that supposed to mean? Andrew shrugged.
"You seem to have a lot going on. Your sister's home, right?"
Spencer leaned back in her chair and drew her bottom lip into her mouth. "Yeah, she just got home last night."
"How'd you know that?" She stopped.
"Wait a second. Andrew drove his mini up and down her street all the time. She'd seen him just yesterday, when she was at the mailbox getting her test scores." She swallowed hard. Now that she thought about it, she might have seen his black mini drive by the day she and Ren were in the hot tub together. He must have been driving it up and down her street a lot to notice Melissa was home. What if Andrew was the one skulking around spying on her? What if Andrew wrote that creepy Covet email? Andrew was so competitive it seemed possible. Wouldn't sending threatening messages be a good way to throw someone off her game and make it easier to be reelected as next year's class president? Or, even better, beat out his competition for valedictorian? And the long hair. Maybe she'd seen him in Allie's old window. Unbelievable.
Spencer stared at Andrew incredulously.
Is something wrong?
Andrew asked, looking concerned. I have to go. She gathered up her books and walked out of the reading room.
Wait,
Andrew called. Spencer kept going, but as she pushed through the library doors, she realized that she didn't feel enraged. Sure, it was bizarre that Andrew was spying on her, but if Andrew was A, Spencer was safe. Whatever Andrew thought he had on her, it was nothing. Nothing, compared to what Allison knew. She reached the door to the commons. Coming in at the same time was Emily Fields. Hey, Emily said. A nervous look crossed her face.
Hey, Spencer answered.
Emily readjusted her Nike backpack. Spencer pushed her bangs off her face. When was the last time she'd spoken to Emily? It got cold out, huh? Emily asked. Spencer nodded.
Yeah.
Emily smiled in that I-don't-know-what-to-say-to-you way. Then Tracy Reed, another swimmer, grabbed Emily's arm. When is our swimsuit money due? She asked. As Emily answered, Spencer wiped some non-existent dirt off her blazer and wondered if she could just walk away or if she had to say a formal goodbye. Then something on Emily's wrist caught her eye. Emily was still wearing her blue string bracelet from sixth grade. Allison had made them for everyone right after the accident. The Jenna thing happened. Initially, they'd just wanted to get Jenna's brother, Toby. It was supposed to be a prank. After the five of them planned it, Allie went across the street to watch through Toby's treehouse window. And then when it happened, it did something horrible to Jenna. After the ambulance pulled away from Jenna's house, Spencer discovered something about the accident none of the other girls ever found out. Toby saw Allie, but Allie saw Toby doing something just as bad. He couldn't tell on her, because then she'd tell on him. Not long after, Allie made everyone the bracelets to remind them they were best friends forever, and now that they shared a secret like this, they had to protect one another forever. Spencer waited for Allie to tell the others that someone saw her, but she never did. When the cops questioned Spencer after Allie went missing, they asked if Allie had any enemies, anyone who hated her so much they might want to hurt her. Spencer said that Allie was a popular girl, and like any popular girl, there were some girls who didn't like her, but it was just jealousy. That, of course, was a bold-faced lie. There were people who hated Allie, and Spencer knew she should tell the police what Allie told her about the Jenna thing, that maybe Toby wanted to hurt Allie. But how could she tell them that without telling them why? Spencer couldn't get through a day without passing Toby and Jenna's house on her street, but they'd been sent away to boarding school and hardly ever came home, so she thought their secret was safe. They were safe from Toby. And Spencer was safe from ever having to tell her best friends what she alone knew. As Tracy Reed said goodbye, Emily turned around. She seemed surprised Spencer was still standing there. I've got to get to class, she said. Good to see you, though. Bye, Spencer answered, and she and Emily exchanged one last awkward smile. 15. Insulting his masculinity is such a deal-breaker.
You guys are looking lazy. I want to see better form, Coach Lauren yelled at them from the deck.
On Thursday afternoon, Emily bobbed with the other swimmers in the crystal blue water of Rosewood's Anderson Memorial Natatorium, listening to their youngish, former Olympian coach, Lauren Kincaid, scream at them. The pool was 25 yards wide, 50 yards long, with a small diving well. Huge skylights mirrored the length of the pool, so when you did backstrokes in the evening, you could look up and see the stars. Emily held on to the wall and pulled her cap over her ears. Okay, better form. She needed to really concentrate today. Last night, after getting back from the creek with Maya, she'd lain on her bed for a long time, flip-flopping from feeling warm and happy about the fun she and Maya had had, to feeling uneasy and antsy about Maya's confession. I'm not sure I like guys. I think I'd like someone more like me. Did Maya mean what Emily thought she meant? Thinking about how giddy Maya had been at the waterfall, not to mention how much they'd tickled and touched each other, Emily felt nervous. After getting home last night, she'd rifled through her swimming bag for that note from A from the day before. She read it over and over again, picking apart every word until her eyes blurred. By dinner time, Emily decided she needed to throw herself back into swimming. No more skipped practices. No more slacking. From now on, she'd be the model swimmer girl. Ben paddled over to her and put his hands on the wall.
I missed you yesterday.
She should make a new start with Ben, too. With his freckles, piercing blue eyes, slightly stubbly jaw, and beautifully chiseled swimmer's body, he was hot, right? She tried to imagine Ben jumping off the Marwin Trail Bridge. Would he laugh or think it was immature?
So, where were you?
Ben asked, blowing on his goggles to defog them. Tutoring for Spanish.
Want to come over to my house after practice? My parents won't be home till 8.
I'm not sure if I can. Emily pushed away from the wall and started to tread water. She stared down at her blurrily pumping legs and feet.
Why not?
Ben pushed off the wall to join her. Because she couldn't come up with an excuse.
You know you want to,
Ben whispered. He took some water into his hands and began splashing her. Maya had done the same thing yesterday, but this time Emily jerked away. Ben stopped splashing.
What?
Don't. Ben put his hands around her waist.
No, you don't like to get splashed?
He asked in a baby voice. She took his hands off her.
Don't.
He backed away.
Fine.
Sighing, Emily floated over to the other side of the lane. She liked Ben. She really did. Maybe she should just go over to Ben's after swimming. They'd watch TiVo'd episodes of American Chopper, eat pizza delivered from DeSilvio's, and he'd feel underneath her unsexy sports bra. Suddenly, tears sprang to her eyes. She really didn't want to sit on Ben's itchy blue basement couch, picking oregano spices out of her teeth and rolling her tongue around the inside of his mouth. She just didn't. She wasn't the kind of girl who could fake things. But did that mean she wanted to break up? It was hard to make up your mind about a boy when he was right in your swimming lane, 4 feet away. Her sister Carolyn, who was practicing in the lane next to her, tapped Emily on the shoulder. Everything all right?
Yeah, Emily mumbled, grabbing a blue kickboard.
Okay. Carolyn looked as if she wanted to say more. After her trip with Maya to the creek yesterday, Emily had skidded the Volvo into the parking lot just in time to see Carolyn exiting the natatorium's double doors. When Carolyn asked where Emily had been, Emily had told her she had to tutor for Spanish. It seemed like Carolyn believed her, despite Emily's damp hair and the funny ticky noise the car was making, something it did only when it was cooling down from a drive. Even though the sisters looked alike, both had broad freckles over their noses, chlorine-bleached reddish-brown hair, and had to wear a lot of Maybelline Great Lash to lengthen their stubby lashes. And even though they shared a room, they weren't close. Carolyn was a quiet, demure, and obedient girl, and although Emily was all those things too, Carolyn seemed really satisfied to be that way. Coach Lauren blew the whistle.
Kicking time! Line up!
The swimmers lined up from fastest to slowest, kickboards in front of them. Ben was in front of Emily. He looked at her and raised an eyebrow. I can't come over tonight, she said quietly, so the other boy swimmers, who were crowded around behind her and laughing at Gemma Curran's fake tan gone wrong, couldn't hear. Sorry. Ben's mouth flattened into a straight line.
Yeah, as if that's a surprise.
Then, as Lauren blew the whistle, He pushed off the wall and began dolphin kicking. Uneasy, Emily waited until Lauren blew the whistle again and pushed off behind him. As she swam, Emily stared at Ben's pumping legs. It was so dorky how he wore a cap over his already short hair. He got so OCD before races, too, shaving off every hair on his body, including the ones on his arms and legs. Now, his feet made exaggeratedly huge splashes, which sprayed right into Emily's face. She glared at his head bobbing in front of her and pumped her legs harder. Even though she'd left 5 seconds behind him, Emily reached the opposite wall at almost the same time Ben did. He turned to her, pissed. Swim team etiquette dictated that no matter how big a swimming star you were, if someone caught your feet on a set, you let them go ahead of you. But Ben just pushed back off the wall. "Ben!" Emily called, the irritation in her voice showing. He stood up in the shallow end and turned around.
"What?"
"Let me go in front of you." Ben rolled his eyes and ducked back underwater. Emily shoved off the wall and kicked crazily until she caught up to him. He reached the wall and turned to face her.
"Would you stay off my ass?" he practically yelled.
Emily burst out laughing. "You're supposed to let me go."
"Maybe if you didn't leave right on top of me, you wouldn't be on top of me."
She snorted. "I can't help it if I'm faster than you." Ben's mouth fell open. "Oops." Emily licked her lips. "Ben."
"No."
He held up his hand.
"Just go swim really fast, okay?"
He tossed his goggles onto the deck. They bounced awkwardly and landed back in the water, narrowly missing Gemma's fake tanned shoulder. "Ben." He glared at her, then turned and got out of the pool.
"Whatever."
Emily watched him angrily push open the boys' locker room door. She shook her head, watching the door slowly swing back and forth. Then she remembered the thing Maya said yesterday. "Fuck a moose," she tried out quietly, and smiled. 16. Never trust an invite without a return address. "So, are you coming over tonight?" Hannah switched her BlackBerry to her other ear and waited for Sean's answer. It was Thursday after school. She and Mona had just met for a quick cappuccino on campus, but Mona had to leave early to practice her drive for the mother-daughter golf tournament she was competing in this weekend. Now, Hannah sat on her front porch, talking to Sean and watching the 6-year-old twins next door draw surprisingly anatomically correct naked boys in chalk all over their driveway.
"I can't," Sean answered. "I'm really sorry."
"But Thursday is nerve night. You know that?" Hannah and Sean were hooked on this reality show Nerve, which documented the lives of 4 couples who'd met online. Tonight's episode was extremely important, because their favorite 2 characters, Nate and Fiona, were about to do it. Hannah thought it might at least start a conversation.
I have a meeting tonight."
"A meeting for what?"
V Club."
Hannah's mouth fell open. "V Club? As in virginity club? Can you skip it?" He was quiet for a minute.
"I can't."
"Well, are you at least coming to Knowles tomorrow?"
Another pause. "I don't know."
"Sean, you have to," her voice squeaked.
"All right,"
he answered.
"I guess Noel would be kind of pissed if I didn't."
"I would be pissed too," Hannah added.
"I know. See you tomorrow."
"Sean, wait," Hannah started, but he'd already hung up. Hannah unlocked her house. Sean had to come to the party tomorrow. She'd hatched a foolproof romantic plan. She'd take him to Knowles Woods, they'd confess their love for each other, and then they'd have sex. V Club couldn't argue with having sex if you were in love, could it? Besides, the Conwoods were legendary. They were known as the Manhood Woods, because so many guys at so many con parties had lost their virginity there. It was rumored that the trees whispered sex secrets to new recruits. She stopped at the mirror in the hallway and pulled up her shirt to examine her taut stomach muscles. She swiveled sideways to investigate her small, round butt. Then she bent forward to look at her skin. Yesterday's blotchiness was gone. She bared her teeth. One bottom front tooth crossed over a canine. Had they always been that way? She threw her thick-strapped, gold-leather handbag onto the kitchen table and opened the freezer. Her mom didn't buy Ben and Jerry's, so Tofutti Cutie 50% less sugar faux ice cream sandwiches would have to do. She took out three and began to greedily unwrap the first one. As she took a bite, she felt that familiar tug to eat more. "Here, Hannah, have another profiterole," Allie had whispered to her that day they visited her dad in Annapolis. Then Allie turned to Kate, her dad's girlfriend's daughter, and said, "Hannah's so lucky. She can eat anything and not gain an ounce." It wasn't true, of course. That's what made it so mean. Hannah was already chubby and seemed to be getting more so. Kate giggled, and Allie, who was supposed to be on Hannah's side, laughed too. "I got you something." Hannah jumped. Her mom sat at the little telephone table in a hot pink Champion sports bra and black flared leg yoga pants. "Oh," Hannah said quietly. Ms. Marin appraised Hannah, her eyes settling on the ice cream sandwiches in her hands. "Do you really need three?" Hannah looked down. She'd chomped through one sandwich in less than 10 seconds, hardly even tasting it, and had already unwrapped the next. She smiled faintly at her mom and quickly stuffed the remaining cuties back into the freezer. When she turned back around, her mother set a little blue Tiffany bag on the table. Hannah looked at it questioningly. "This?" "Open it." Inside was a little blue Tiffany box, and inside that was the complete Tiffany toggle set, the charm bracelet, round silver earrings, plus the necklace. The very same kind she'd had to hand over to the Tiffany's woman at the police station. Hannah held them up, letting them sparkle in the overhead light. "Wow." Ms. Marin shrugged. "You're welcome." Then, to signify that the conversation was finished, she retreated to the den, unrolled her purple yoga mat, and turned on her Power Yoga DVD. Hannah slowly slid the earrings back in the bag, confused. Her mom was so weird. That was when she noticed a creamy square card envelope sitting on the little telephone table. Hannah's name and address were typewritten in all caps. She smiled. An invite to a sweet party was just the thing she needed to cheer up. "Breathe in through your nose, out through your mouth," the soothing yogi instructed from the TV in the den. Ms. Marin stood with her arms placidly by her sides. She didn't even move when her BlackBerry started singing Flight of the Bumblebee, which meant she had an email. This was her me time. Hannah grabbed the envelope and climbed upstairs to her room. She sat down on her four-poster bed, felt the edges of her billion thread count sheets, and smiled at Dot, sleeping peacefully on his doggy bed. "Come here, Dot," she whispered. He stretched and sleepily climbed into her arms. Hannah sighed. Maybe she just had PMS, and these jittery, uneasy, the world is caving in feelings would go away in a few days. She sliced the envelope open with her fingernail and frowned. It wasn't an invitation, and the note didn't really make sense. "Hannah, even Daddy doesn't love you best. A." What was that supposed to mean? But when she unfolded the accompanying page stuffed inside the envelope, she yelped. It was a color printout from a private school's online newsletter. Hannah looked at the familiar people in the photo. The caption said, "Kate Randall was Barnbury School's student speaker at the benefit. Pictured here with her mother, Isabel Randall, and Ms. Randall's fiancé, Tom Marin." Hannah blinked quickly. Her father looked the same as when she'd last seen him, and although her heart stopped when she read the word fiancé, when had that happened? It was the image of Kate that made her skin itch. Kate looked more perfect than ever. Her skin was glowing, and her hair was perfect. She had her arms gleefully wrapped around her mom and Mr. Marin. Hannah would never forget the moment she first saw Kate. Allie and Hannah had just gotten off Amtrak in Annapolis, and at first, Hannah saw only her dad leaning up against the hood of his car. But then the car door opened, and Kate stepped out. Her long chestnut hair was straight and shiny, and she held herself like the kind of girl who'd taken ballet since she was 2. Hannah's first instinct was to crouch behind a pole. She looked at her snug jeans and stretched-out cashmere sweater and tried not to hyperventilate. This was why Dad left, she thought. He wanted a daughter who wouldn't embarrass him. "Oh my God," Hannah whispered, searching the envelope for a return address. Nothing. Something occurred to her. The only person who really knew about Kate was Allison. Her eyes moved to the A on the note. The tofutti cutie burbled in her stomach. She ran for the bathroom and grabbed the extra toothbrush and the ceramic cup next to the sink. Then she knelt down over the toilet and waited. Tears dotted the corners of her eyes. "Don't start this again," she told Allison. Her eyes moved to the A on the note. The tofutti cutie burbled in her stomach. She ran for the bathroom and grabbed the extra toothbrush and the ceramic cup next to the sink. Then she knelt down over the toilet and waited. Tears dotted the corners of her eyes. "Don't start this again," she told herself, gripping the toothbrush hard by her side. "You're better than this." Hannah stood up and stared in the mirror. Her face was flushed, her hair was strewn around her face, and her eyes were red and puffy. Slowly, she put the toothbrush back in the cup. "I'm Hannah, and I'm fabulous," she said to her reflection. But it didn't sound convincing. Not at all. 17. Duck, duck, goose. Okay. Aria blew her long bangs out of her eyes.
"In this scene, you have to wear this colander on your head and talk a lot about a baby we don't have."
Noel frowned and brought his thumb to his pink, bow-shaped lips.
"Why do I have to wear a colander on my head, Finland?"
"Because," Aria answered, "it's an absurdist play. It's supposed to be, like, absurd."
"Gotcha," Noel grinned.
It was Friday morning, and they were sitting on desks in English class. After yesterday's Waiting for Godot disaster, Ezra's next assignment had been for them to break up into groups and write their own existentialist plays. Existentialist was another way of saying silly and out there. And if anyone could do silly and out there, it was Aria.
"I know something really absurd we could do," Noel said. "We could have this character drive a navigator and, like, after a couple of beers, crash it into his duck pond. But he's, like, fallen asleep at the wheel, so he doesn't notice he's in the duck pond until the next day. There could be ducks in the navigator."
Aria frowned. "How could we stage all that? It sounds impossible."
"I don't know," Noel shrugged.
"But that happened to me last year, and it was really absurd. And awesome."
Aria sighed. She hadn't exactly chosen Noel to be her partner because she thought he'd be a good co-writer. She looked around for Ezra, but he unfortunately wasn't watching them in fitful jealousy. "How about if we make one of the characters think he's a duck?" she suggested. "He could randomly quack."
Sure.
Noel wrote that down on a piece of lined paper with a gnawed-up Mont Blanc pen.
"Hey, maybe we could shoot this with my dad's Canon DV camera and have this as a movie instead of a boring play?"
Aria paused. "Actually, that would be kind of cool." Noel smiled.
"Then we could keep the navigator scene."
"I guess." Aria wondered if the cons really had a spare navigator to crash. Probably. Noel nudged Mason Byers, who was paired up with James Freed.
Dude, we're going to have a navigator in our play. And pyrotechnics.
Wait, pyrotechnics? Arya asked.
Nice,
Mason said. Arya clamped her lip shut. Honestly, she didn't have the energy for this. Last night, she hardly slept. Plagued by yesterday's cryptic text message, she'd spent half the night thinking and furiously knitting a purple hat with ear flaps. It was awful to think that someone knew not only about her and Ezra, but also about that stuff with her dad. What if this A person sent her mom messages next? What if A already had? Arya didn't want her mom to find out. Not now, and not that way. Arya also couldn't shake the idea that the A message might actually be from Allison. There just weren't that many people who knew. A few faculty members, maybe, and Meredith knew, obviously. But they didn't know Arya. If the text was from Allison, that meant she was alive. Or not.